we'll open up the floor for discussion. So comments or questions, and we'll try to keep our responses short
so we can move things along.
Well, thanks for that illuminating discussion. I just want to raise maybe an issue and a question that follows on all four presentations. And my friend Rob Jester and I agree on a lot of things, but I want to take you to task on one. and this is, I think, the equation of secularism with religious freedom. I think, secularism is to talk about a secular state or a secular society is a form of political order, and religious freedom concerns the protection of individual rights. And I think in some of the discussion around religious freedom, there's been an elision between those two ideas. I think there's a natural affinity between secularism and religious freedom, but I don't think they're the same thing. And I wonder, actually, strategically, in terms of advancing a foreign policy that promotes religious freedom, if it might be more productive, perhaps this follows on what Dan had mentioned, to talk about a harmonious society, or harmonious and prosperous society, and religious freedom being a dimension of that. And I think some of the research that Dr. Grimm has done actually helps to provide some substantive support for that argument that the advancement of religious freedom lowers levels of conflict and so on. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, rather strategically, if that might allay some of the concerns raised by people like Elizabeth Schaffman Hurd, that the bureaucratization of religious freedom and its promotion can have unintended consequences of aggravating local or regional conflict. Is a strategy of promoting religious freedom that, as a dimension of promoting a harmonious and prosperous society, is there some advantage to that, or are there some disadvantages to it as well?
There's a correlation between higher restrictions on religion and higher social hostilities involving religion. And therefore, the opposite's true, where there's lower restrictions on religion, then there's also lower social hostilities. That doesn't mean that the best way to lower social hostilities is to lower all the restrictions. That's not necessarily what the data say. But the two do work in tandem. So, it may be that the social hostilities, as they rise, the government's response is to try to tamp them down. So all these mechanisms are operating. And so the data don't suggest a very simple policy solution, if that makes sense. But it is, having said that when you look at the individual types of restrictions that our study monitors, for instance, whether women are harassed by people in society over religious dress. So even when you look at any particular types of social hostility, you find that those are also more present in countries where there are high restrictions on religion. So I think that there is still some connection between those, even when you get to individual issues. But the data really don't provide a policy map to say here's what should be done. Rather, it gives some basic information that informs the discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. It is very encouraging that you guys have started somehow quantifying these things and bringing it to focus in terms of mapping and actual numbers. Obviously, because religion is primarily qualitative, it is very, very difficult to capture it in any quantitative sense. But my question is, or something that you may want to pay attention to, if it is true in the context of foreign policy, as we are all concerned about, very often we sort of disassociate it from the domestic issues and use our own compass or ethnocentrism. In other words, we are looking at most of these things as we are here, and then, of course, let's write reports about all the other countries. But indeed, if you look at it carefully, United States, religious freedom has a lot of problems. I'm wondering, to what extent have you guys been cataloging a report about the changing dynamics of U.S. insensitivity to religion. I mean, there are a lot. Romney's election, his background as a Mormon was an issue. If you go to, there are so many issues about religious tensions in U.S. I mean, have you guys been cataloging these issues? Otherwise, it creates an impression as though you everything is okay in the West. I mean, look at people who cannot play soccer with turbans, you can wear burqa in France. All these issues are there in the West. And meanwhile, we stand at the West and somehow write reports about everybody else using our own background as the normal and then judging in a way. So I think we have to be careful about that. And also with the quantitative aspect, the issues have to be nuanced more carefully in a sense that if you are mapping or cataloging data as to religious insensitivity in a country, it has a lot to do with localities. It could be a big country, but these issues tend to focus in particular small localities. So if you broaden it and map it to the whole country, there is a mistake right there. You get what I'm trying to say? In other words, France is this, but it could be just a small part of France that is having that problem. So there is a lot of disaggregation that has to go in. You can even look at the situation. Is the person committing all the social tension surrounding religion based on people in that country or is being perpetrated by a foreigner in that country? You have to it has a lot of complexities involved. So I would just want to solicit your views on this.
Yeah, I'll respond just briefly. What you've said is exactly true, that if we were only monitoring the world and not tracking this in the U.S., that would be quite a biased study. In our previous study that came out last fall, we actually had a whole section on the United States showing that both government restrictions on religion and social hostilities involving religion rose significantly in the U.S. Over the past years. The study that just came out last week did not see a decline in those levels. So it appears that the level of social hostilities and government restrictions in the U.S. has gone up a bit and stayed. It's still in the moderate. Both are still in the moderate level compared to, you know, some other countries. But the U.S. is higher on these measures than a country like Brazil, for instance, or Japan. So we do put the U.S. in context. It tends to be a bit lower than countries like France or the U.K., and then substantially lower than a country like Pakistan. So those are good concerns, and so I can direct you to our reports on that, and we monitor it carefully. The other point regarding how a situation in a very populous, complex country could be driven by local issues, and of course that's true in how our data work. So in Indonesia, for instance, where Aceh province has instituted very strict penalties for violating religious norms, and those are enforced by the government, that tends to affect the entire score of Indonesia. Part of the reason that we don't weight it just for that province is that when the national government approves of that or doesn't change those laws, there is some, if not direct, tacit approval by the national government. And then what we've seen in recent years is that model has been advocated for other parts of Indonesia, and there's been a growing trend towards pushing for the greater enforcement of religious norms from other people in government. So even if it is something isolated or in one part of a country, we do see that tends to affect the whole country. And I'll just give one last example. It's in India. Almost every type of social hostility we monitor happens somewhere in India. It's the second largest country, and it's a very complex religious situation. And so you could say, well, if you're down in Kerala, the situation is much different than if you're, up in Punjab. And that's very true. So these measures we have reflect what's going on somewhere in a country, and that is a limitation.
Thank you very much. It's Samina Yasmin from the University of Western Australia. My question is about the way the whole discussion about the office of freedom, at least to the extent that I've been able to understand, assumes that there are some standards that a country like America or Canada can follow in terms of engaging with the outside world. My question is that if we look at Danish situation, the Danish cartoon case, to my knowledge, when it came about, in fact, there were diplomats from Denmark of different Muslim countries who approached the Danish government and, in fact, expressed their concern about getting those cartoons published. The way I would read it, it was an indirect use of the idea of what religious freedom means from the point of view of these people. So they were using similar avenues to voice their views, but they were not taken into account. So let me expand the situation and say, what would you say that if a lot of different countries develop their offices of religious freedom, and when something else happened in North America or in Europe, and they in fact approach their governments on the same ground, how would we distinguish in that stage between religious freedom of religion and freedom of speech, with the idea of freedom of religion as seen in North America be superior to or equal to or inferior to the idea of freedom of religion, which in some ways subscribes the idea of limiting freedom of speech? So, thank you.
I'm going to take a crack at that. it's an answer, it's a practical answer that you may not like, but I think will also respond to some comments that Anne made earlier, and that is that it's important, especially when we're thinking about religious freedom, the way that, for example, a state like Canada will practice religious freedom. The ideas in its foreign policy are not sort of being imagined out of nowhere. I mean, in the case of the Office of Religious Freedom, it's consistently referred to by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, by the Prime Minister, the people who are making policy and direction for the Government of Canada, as part of a package of Canadian values. And so when you talk about how would you kind of adjudicate this balance between freedom of speech and religious freedom, that's a completely legitimate question. It's a question that we face domestically in Canada on a fairly regular basis. The answer is that I think the way that the sitting government interprets those values would be the way that an ambassador would probably be responsible to represent them as well. I mean, you can correct me on that, but it would seem to me that is that domestic conversation is not incidental. It actually shapes the way that now that would mean, which is the unsatisfying part of this answer, that it would be an explicitly Canadian approach or idea. In some ways, I don't think a Canadian diplomat necessarily needs to apologize for advancing Canadian values, but you are right. It would not be, there would be a contest, a conversation there, which I hope would be a conversation, actually. But, I mean, that's mine.
Well, I would say that you've put your finger on what is the debate. Is there a hierarchy of rights? And it, in this case that you've cited, it's between freedom of free speech expression and religion. But going back to as I defined it for Islam, there is something as religion itself that must be protected, not defamed. It's something that we don't have in our law. It's on the individuals, but it's a situation where you would hope that there's enough respect all around that someone would know where is the boundary. An individual would know what the boundary is between free speech and not insulting the other. It doesn't always happen. I don't even see the Mohammed caricature as an issue of foreign policy. It could have happened, with social communications. There's no boundary. It could happen here and you would have the same dilemma. Another issue of hierarchy of rights is that of freedom of belief in the faith of a certain religion and equality of men and women, which is one we face at home and is faced in several countries. So that these are real hard issues that have to be worked out. That's the simple answer.
This is sort of a follow-up on a previous question. You were talking about the politicization of religion, particularly in the United States. And right now, there's a lot of that conversation that's occurring. And unfortunately, that conversation is filled with misnomers, misunderstanding. It's being used for political gain. I mean, if we even look at particularly the 2008 presidential election, we have President Obama, who is really being termed the other, not only racially, but a presumed faith tradition, even to the point of being accused of not even being an American citizen. And so we hear this debate being so politicized for, again, for political gain, for power. And I don't think that's, my personal feeling is that this debate has not reached its crescendo yet. So what are some strategies? I mean, and also in the United States, there's an anti-academic conversation that's also happening within the same group of people who are having this debate. And what are some strategies for excising debate, concern, actions around religious freedom? What are some strategies for excising that from politics, from politicization?
It's a difficult problem to address, but I think the politicization of core human rights issues is a serious problem, and one needs to constantly work for forms of discourse in the public sphere that are attempting to bridge, especially when it comes to fundamental human rights, bridge the diverse concerns across the partisan divides. That's why, to me, the process of coming to a international consensus on Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations is such a brilliant model of that conversation, because they were dealing with huge divides. You know, at the table were, you know, Stalinist Russia, China, India, you know, the religious divides, regional divides, deep ideological divides. The way they got to consensus was finding ways of integrating the diverse perspectives, in a sense, the goods at play in these contentious debates. So I don't agree with Elizabeth Hurd, bottom line, but the issues she's raising, the concerns she's raising, I'm agreeing with a lot of the concerns. I think she takes it, she flates the concerns and takes it in a direction that I probably wouldn't want to go. But her concerns need to be at the table. And so it's, you know, I think one of the challenges for an Office of Religious Freedom is to pull back from the partisan, you know, not to position itself, and to try to find ways to bring these diverse voices into the deep discourse about, you know, because these are such fundamental values, right, in international discourse on human rights.
Can I just follow up on that with a relatively, an unusual celebration of nonpartisan cooperation here in the Canadian Parliament? I mean, usually when we talk about Parliament, it kind of gets drawn into partisanship. But as an example of something really, really tangible, and I think a really, really, really excellent piece that's happened here in Canada, we had in the last session Motion 382, which got passed, and that was a private member's bill by a member of Shipley. And that it was a motion which was essentially extolling religious freedom and it as a core principle of Canadian foreign relations, and it went through the House of Commons and it got unanimous consent. And some people sort of looked at that and they said, well, it's just a motion, you know, it's not binding, and so on and so forth. As a cultural piece of all parties in the House of Commons actually coming together and voting for this thing unanimously, I actually think that's quite important. I think that was an essential piece So religious freedom is not just a conservative issue, even though they're the sitting government that worked on this office, because all the other parties have indeed come alongside this motion and said, no, this is a Canadian issue. This is not a conservative part of Canada. This is a Canadian issue. And I thought that was really significant, a great gesture, actually.
I just want to pick up on something Rob just said and then get to my question. I have sat in the speaker in the gallery in the House of Commons and in debates, all-party debates, take note debates, where a particular situation of religious persecution was under discussion, and have heard a member of the opposition stand and say, Mr. Speaker, you will hear no partisan voice in the Parliament tonight, because this is not a partisan issue. So in all of my dealings with parliamentarians of different stripes, perhaps my case is unique, but it has been my fortune to be in that situation where I've never heard a partisan concern expressed in the context of pursuing the right to freedom of religion or belief in a particular situation. What I wanted to comment on more generally is that in our discussion, we've spent a lot of time at the theoretical level in trying to get our ducks in a row in terms of what do we mean when we say. We've talked quite a bit about members of religious communities or religious communities themselves demanding rights in the name of freedom of religion or belief. We've talked about suspicion and mistrust between religious communities resulting in social hostilities that have to do with territory, identity, mistrust, who knows, there's a whole host. Where we haven't spent a lot of time, and in particular this is an issue when we talk about do we really need to retain our concern about freedom of religion or belief, and I'm not saying religious freedom specifically intentionally, because the or belief part is very important. In situations where governments do not accept that a religious community, in fact, is a religion, and they are an unrecognized religious minority, the inclusion of or belief puts that government right back in the responsible seat of it doesn't matter whether or not you recognize this community as a religion or not. They profess a belief and you have certain obligations towards them. So what we haven't really discussed a lot is those instances where a government, in collaboration with the state religion's representatives, pursues a deliberate policy of trying to wipe out a particular religious community, recognized or unrecognized. It's been argued we could go after freedom of expression, we could go after arbitrary arrest. There's the whole family of human rights that could be pursued in an effort to assist those who are in that situation of persecution. But it's kind of like banning a nuclear bomb. If you don't get rid of what's underlying the desire to use that armament, we'll go after each other with pitchforks. At some point, you have to deal with what's the underlying problem. And in situations where a religious community is being persecuted simply because they exist as a religious community, we need to acknowledge that in the way that we understand its nature and take it up with that state. So that's what scares me about Elizabeth Hurd's analysis, is that it takes in many very legitimate concerns, and I really appreciate you teasing them out for us, but that is one that I don't think she does address.
I would agree. The issue of registration of religious, state recognition of religious, particular religions, I think is a huge issue, and I'm almost wondering whether there needs to be some international conversation about, or some body. Religions are transnational entities. Why do we leave it to nation states to say this is a religion?
I've been thinking a lot this week about the type of people who make up the groups who go into these countries and work with them on the religious freedom issues. And obviously, what comes to mind is foreign policy experts, academics in religious fields. And in a sense, that group would be fighting for religious freedom as an intellectual right. And I was wondering about the place of actual practitioners of religions in Canada and America who, like an American Buddhist or a Canadian Muslim, going to help and join these groups, and how their own role would be very emotional and very hitting them close to home. So I was just wondering if you had any input about the way these groups are formed and the role of like actual believers in these international issues.
One thing in our latest report, we have a section that catalogs initiatives by governments and groups in society to try to reduce restrictions and hostilities. And you might find that section of the report interesting because it catalogs all the different ways people are involved, including religious groups that are starting. For instance, in Tanzania, there was an interfaith camp for kids. I think involved several thousand kids, Muslims and Christians, the two main groups in Tanzania, and you know, got them involved in art and music, and then they'd have a joint prayer service. So that was very much a faith-based group that had connections internationally. So I think there's a tremendous variety of groups involved in this. So I think what you're saying is really part of the landscape, and none of us, being from a faith-based group, we're not actually, you know, that's not what comes to mind maybe first or what we talk about initially, but it's certainly a large part of the scene of people trying to address these issues.
That's a great question. I actually think it's essential that and that's sort of, you know, this extra track of foreign policy, right? It's not state to state, it's community to community. Because when it comes down to discussing the world of religion and politics, or just religions, period, you need co-religionists to have religious conversations. I can't do Buddhist political theology. I can't do, you know, and the Canadian state can't do it either. Heaven forbid the Canadian state do it. Absolutely, I could do, you know, as a Christian, I could do Christian political theology. And there are a lot of groups, for example, I'm aware of a couple of Christian NGOs that have done work, particularly in Uganda, to help think through some of the challenges that states have, I think, rightly stood against in terms of some of the legislation that's come forward there. And I actually think Christian political theology is especially what's needed in terms of thinking about how actually do we relate, you know, textual and hermeneutical questions to actual politics. States can't do that, and states probably shouldn't do that, but co-religionists can, and that's why I think it's essential.
There's a question from the High Commissioner of Nigeria. The central concern from the perspective of the already disadvantaged Global South is how does the conversation about the desirable objective of religious freedom not become handicapped by a perception that it is the latest culture war at the behest of the West, of Western hubris? Maybe pose, just open that question. I have some thoughts, but maybe we could close with this question, big question, I think it relates back to one of the fundamental issues of how does a conversation like this really truly become an international conversation where diverse voices are at the table in a big way on these core human rights issues and help to shape the conversation.
I'll just say one thing. As academics engage with this, one of the basic ways that we do this is to go to have a conference, present our data, and have people respond and critique it. So then, in that, the academic approach just subjects your interpretations and your data and your concepts to critique. And so I think that's one positive contribution an academic approach can take is if I were to present my data in Nigeria, and then have Nigerian academics respond to it and say, well, here's what we think's right, here's what we think's wrong, and look at it this way. That's often a very positive and non-confrontational type of environment. So that's just from an academic point of view.
I would say that whatever goes on between diplomats and academics, with all due respect, is at a certain level, rather elitist, and where you get the real concerns are at the grassroots, where people suffer because their houses burned down or because they didn't get the job because they're the wrong, whatever. So that the answer lies in the local leaders, at the local level, and Nigeria is a wonderful example of where sometimes we read headlines that are all negative, but in fact there's a lot positive going on, and that's where the answer is, and that's where the antidote is, and perhaps the challenge is to make that better known. It takes a lot of courage, actually, to actually speak out in the in an atmosphere of pressure and even coercion at times, but there's strength in numbers, and where the networks come in, not the states, but you know, the various networks, the groups who work together, is that they can help get the word around. Their solidarity, spiritual strength for these people, and there's this wonderful film of the the pastor and the imam about the city of Jos. When a few years ago this was shown, this was great in terms of showing people that. The message is that if you believe in a religion, one or the other, it's not going to necessarily lead to conflict, but actually it could, when you work together, you could actually do something to help prevent HIV/AIDS in an area, but get more girls in school. I mean, the concrete stuff. Mm-hmm. Get people to know each other, understand why the customs are different, and that's the answer.
Yeah. I think the question is actually posing a fundamental question that actually deserves more work in a sense, another conference. Professor Arvind Sharma is actually engaged in a major effort to bring diverse voices to take another look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, sort of bringing some of these big global concerns to the table around Universal Declaration. Jacques Maritain, way back when, shortly after the Universal Declaration was published, drafted, accepted, and proclaimed, wrote a commentary for UNESCO that brought together a whole array of about 50 different voices from around the world on the new document. But he himself said that, we will have to revisit this document generation after generation. There has to, the evolving discourse on sort of these core human rights has to be revisited because new questions are going to be posed, and some of these fundamental questions, I think, will be on the table for us, and so some core questions have been raised. Others are probably have not been voiced, and I have a few questions I haven't had a chance to get at here. Time for a break, and the conversation will continue. The two next sessions will start in about 15 minutes or so.